I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today. We're joined by Rajan Khanna. He's got a new book out, which I have right here, called Raining Fire. This is the third book in his series that is out now through Pyre. The other books in the series are Falling Sky and Rising Tide. And this, I think, finishes up the trilogy. Rajan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me back.
So that bears the obvious question. Is this the final book or just the third book in the series?
It's the final book. I mean, in the sense that I don't intend to continue it at this time. But, you know, the lovely thing about the genre is people can return to worlds, you know, if they want to in the future. So so the door's open. But for this particular series, this is the end.
Excellent. I read the first two books in the series, so I will highly recommend it. And this third book, Raining Fire, looks great. I just got it a couple weeks ago. I haven't gotten into it yet, but I'm looking forward to getting into it. As I believe I've mentioned the other times we've had Rajan on the show, the covers on these are amazing. So maybe if you can reiterate who the artist is for these books.
Yeah, so the artist is Chris McGrath, who is the cover artist for The Dresden Files and a lot of other really great stuff at the Craft series. He's done those as well. And I was really lucky because my publisher came to me with the pick early on and said, what do you think? And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And they've been able to have him do all books in the series. And I actually think the third one is the best yet. And he's a local artist, so we sometimes communicate over email. He feels the same way too. So I'm just really, really excited to have him on these books.
Patrick and I have spoken at length about how, well, it's mostly me that gets a lot of books sent by the publishers. Patrick, you get a decent amount these days or
no,
not?
I get a trickle, and that's on purpose because I feel guilty that I, you know, I can't do book reviews and we don't have book reviewers for the site anymore. Mm-hmm. So I feel guilty and I tell them, you know, don't send me as much stuff anymore. And so I just get a trickle of things.
I wish I had that sense of control and minimalism in my life because I feel the same way. It's like I have to deal
but
with these
read,
books.
But you read a lot of the books that they send you, John. So, I don't feel any guilt whatsoever for you getting books.
No, I don't feel guilty, but it's more of for my family that has to deal with these towering piles of books.
Yeah.
But the point I was going to make is that I have gotten – if it's a book that I know – this isn't that interesting to me. It's probably not. I have a very good library here. It's the county library that will take books. The only thing they're picky about is they don't want if they were in your basement collecting molds.
Sure.
But now they know me because I told them I didn't explain the idea of a podcast to them. I just said like I review books. I get stuff sent to me. These are all brand new books. I maybe read them or I didn't read them. It's like you're getting brand new books, people.
Yeah.
So they know they're cool and they just take them because I figure that's good because then this helps out people too because then people can discover the books and all that. So, but my point is with the Pyre books and Rajan's book in particular, I love the way these books, the cover art, and Pyre has always done a great job of making their books look fantastic that I rarely give these to the library, even if I haven't read them, because I like having them. And I know at some point I'm going to get into that series. I have already read the first two books in this series, but I have tons of Pyre books that I got 6-7 years ago that I'm holding on to because I love looking at them so much. And they're the kinds of books that I would read anyway. So I have complete series of books that I haven't gotten into yet. Rajan, I wonder if you kind of deal with that yourself too. I'm sure you buy a lot of books. Maybe you get some books sent to you to blurb and that kind of thing. What do you
think? Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot less than it used to be just because I live in New York City. So space is at a premium and I've actually had to trim down quite a bit. Am I moving from my last apartment? I unloaded a lot of books, but there's always the pretty ones that I want to hold on to. Like you said, even if I haven't read them, there's this feeling that it just looks good on the shelf and I like holding it in my hands and running my fingers over the cover. So yeah, it's really hard. And I mean, I definitely think that the book as a physical object is something impressive. And, you know, I'm not one to hold on to, say, arcs and things like that, but like a really fine book, it's hard for me to give up.
What do you do with the arcs?
I
struggle with that.
Yeah.
You can't give them to anybody. So I just have them piled up in a corner.
I have some in storage at the moment. So I don't, that's a good question. I mean, I guess you're supposed to destroy them, but I don't really, you know, I feel weird about doing that with books.
I do too.
Even when I worked at Barnes and Noble years ago, and you used to have to strip the covers off the paperbacks when you were done with them and throw them in the dumpster. And I hated that.
I have tons of arcs that people do send me still. And I've got a whole section of my basement with bookshelves and everything. And I have like two bookshelves that are just 2 and 3 layers deep of arcs, because the only option I can think of is recycling. But it's so painful. It's like these are words on paper. I don't want to destroy them.
I feel arcs are what I struggle with the most too, because obviously the library isn't going to take them.
No, they can't. I mean, what are they going to do with them? Yeah.
Yeah, and I even feel a little weird. I will give them to some people, but the problem with it is the arcs usually have the publicist's information on, like phone numbers and email addresses. And when you're in a position as we are as a podcast or a book reviewer, there's trust that you build up between the publicist and everybody else. And I don't want somebody bothering them. So I'm very hesitant to give it to just anybody. If it's just someone that's a science fiction fan who's going to read and enjoy the book, and then, you know, I know they're not going to be, then I'll give it to them. But I'm hesitant to just let it out into the world, because I don't want them to be bothered. Man. So that's my big thing. But anyway, before we get on to our next segment, I do want to let everyone know, if you enjoy the show and you enjoy interviews with folks like Rajan here, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. It really helps us do the show every month. We're very appreciative of all the people who already back us. It means everything to us. So if you feel like you get some value out of the show, some entertainment, find out about some cool new books or albums or whatever we're talking about, consider becoming one of our backers. Even if you did $1 a month, that would help us so much. And it's 25 cents an episode. Is it worth it? I hope it is. So consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Rajan, what is your pick?
Yeah, so this time I have a album, and it's not a new album. It's one that came out last year, but I recently had the pleasure to see PJ Harvey play in Central Park here in New York as part of Summer Stage. And I love PJ Harvey, but I lost track of her last few albums. I think, you know, Aha Hara was the last one that I remember like picking up and listening to. And she played a lot off her last two albums. And the most recent one's called the Hope 6 Demolition Project. And it's really, really, I think at first I was wondering what I should feel about it, because she comes out on stage with this, you know, horn section, like she's playing saxophone and there's a bunch of other saxophone players and a marching drum and things like that. And yet there's this cool, like subversive element to the music, and it still has that kind of edge that she's known for, but she sounds amazing. And, you know, it's all about kind of the world that we live in and, you know, some of the problems going on. The album title, the Hope 6 Demolition Project, there's a song called Community of Hope, which kind of refers to this, I guess, development that existed. And it ends with, they're going to build a Walmart here. So it's kind of about, you know, this housing development that's, you know, turned to crime, and they're going to knock it down and build a Walmart. And there's a lot of songs there's a lot of songs like that on the album, but it's really a different sound, and it has been refreshing for me after coming back from that concert and kind of diving into it. And I would highly recommend it to anyone who has any interest in PJ Harvey at all.
Very cool.
Excellent. You know, Rajan, that reminded me, I haven't read this book, but I just saw a book review of it. I think it came out in the spring. I believe it's called Meet Me in the Bathroom, which is quite a provocative title. I think it's by Lizzie Goodman is the name of the author. And it is about the scene, the rock music scene in New York in the early 2000s. So we're talking like the Strokes and Bryan Adams and that whole scene. And just in the book review, I'm interested in reading it, even though I wasn't a huge fan. I did like some of that music. But talking about the state of the world artistically at the time and how they tended to think that the reason why that music flourished, one of the reasons why, was because of 9/11, it created two things. It took a lot of the cynicism out of sort of the artistic scene, where like an artistic scene can flourish for its own good. And it also kept, for a time, the prices down, the real estate prices down in New York, so that bands could, you know, rent a loft or, you know, and live inexpensively. Whereas I think nowadays in New York, I don't think there's any place that's inexpensive to live in.
No, yeah.
So when you talk about putting the Walmart up and all that, it reminded me of that scene. Now, I believe you've been living in New York for quite some time. I don't know if you've sort of seen that change over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's increasingly becoming a city that only rich people can afford. I mean, especially Manhattan, and people keep getting pushed out further and further. And there's, you know, a lot of, one of the nice things about New York is there used to be a lot of small businesses. It could be like there's a mom and pop store, a restaurant. These guys are getting priced out a lot. There's a lot of banks going up in place of these businesses. So it's, I find it depressing. And at some point in time, I will have to leave just because I won't be able to afford living here anymore. But, you know, there's still some old New York in pockets here and there. And I live in Brooklyn now, and that's a little bit more my speed these days. But yeah, I mean, the city is definitely changing quite a bit.
And I feel Brooklyn has become its own thing. I have a friend who, a musician friend that lives in Brooklyn, and I'd even asked him to meet me in Manhattan to see a show. And he's like, oh, I don't even leave Brooklyn these days. Like, I don't even want to get out of Brooklyn anymore. So
have either of you ever met the last boy in, or was it the last young boy in America or in New York?
Does that make you think of this? Song? Okay. The only living boy in New York.
The only living boy in New York. There's the one.
Yes. Yes. So there you go. No, I have not met him. I think there's several of them. Patrick, what's your pick?
My pick this week is Joe Golem, Occult Detective by Mike Mignola and Christopher Golden.
Mike Mignola, the Hellboy
guy?
Yeah,
whatever.
I don't know how you pronounce it. You're into comics, Roger. Do you say Mignola, Mignola?
I don't actually know. But is it a comic, or is it one of those like illustrated novels?
It's a graphic novel. It is a comic. Okay. So it was a comic that they put it together in a graphic novel. And I think there's an illustrated novel called The Drowning City that I don't know which came first. But essentially the premise is that in 1830s, Lower Manhattan, there was some trouble and earthquakes, and the whole thing flooded and became kind of like Venice. Became a drowning city. And so by the time you get to Joe Golem, Occult Detective, everything is already flooded. People have lived that way for years, for decades. And he is exactly what he sounds like. He's an occult detective. He works for Mr. Church, who kind of gives him missions and things to do. And then Joe gets very upset and like, you know, I'm not your servant. I'm not your buddy. I'm not your sidekick. You can't just tell me what to do. And then he immediately goes out and does whatever Mr. Church has told him to do. So there's an interesting thing going on there. And obviously through the name Joe Golem, you kind of get an idea of who the character is. He keeps having flashbacks to ancient times when a golem had been created to fight witches. And he just keeps having these nightmares about that. And Mr. Church keeps telling him, oh, don't worry about it. Obviously, you know, one of the occult things that we have fought recently infected your brain with something. Here, drink this tea. And then he forgets. So, yeah, there's some interesting things going on there. It's very Hellboyish. I feel like, you know, he's got a great sense of world building and the occult and how magic works. And Christopher Golden is a very prolific writer. He has a ton of books out there. And the team up between them, I thought was very interesting. And it's a great little book. I went ahead and reviewed it over on Kirkus Reviews. So it's up on my Kirkus blog too.
Cool. Raj, and I know that you wrote for a comics website for a time. Are you still into comics? Do you still read them? Do you still follow?
Yeah, I have a hard time keeping up with them. I mean, just, you know, being so busy. You know, comics are one of those things where, you know, they come out every week, and if you don't keep up, you just fall behind. So I read older comics when I can every so often, but, you know, I still struggle just to read books. So I'm not as tapped in as I used to be, but, I still love them, you know, and I still love superhero comics. Like I you know, try to get back to them as often as I can. And I definitely would love to pick up that series, Joe Golem series. That sounds amazing.
Have either of you seen or checked out the YouTube videos from Marvel? It's called Marvel TLDR.
No.
So they do these quick little animated videos that encompass classic Marvel storylines. So they have one as an example, and it's basically to catch people up. Like I know that John has struggled in the past with like the Star Wars books that came out before they threw them all out. You know, where do you start kind of thing? And a lot of people struggle with that with comic books. They're like, where do I start? You know, and so the TLDR series is about kind of getting you caught up on classic stories so that you feel a little bit better. And it's all in 2, 3, 4 minutes. And then you can just jump into whatever series you want. So as an example, they did, they're pushing in the Inhumans right now because they're about to launch that new Inhumans television series. And people are going, you know, what are the Inhumans? Where did they come from? You know, how do I catch up on them? So they have a TLDR that is the Fantastic Four storyline where it introduced the Inhumans. But instead of having to go out and read the entire run, you can watch this 4-minute video, animated video, and it just kind of takes you through the whole introduction of the Inhumans. And then if you want to, at that point, they say, you know, you can go out and you can read from this point on, and you're all caught up. It's kind of
great.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really cool. Oh, my pick this week, which I know, Patrick, you're going to be surprised by this pick because I am not, as we've talked about many times, I am not a gamer. Not for any prejudice against gaming. It's just it never sort of presented itself in my life. A couple months ago, when all the Scalzi books were on sale for like $2, and then you can get the audiobook for like $4. So for like $6, you were able to get the ebook and the audiobook of all the Scalzi books, and I bought them. At the same time I was buying them, there was also this biography on Gary Gygax, who many people know as the creator of Dungeons and Dragons. And it's called Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax, and I can't read the full title. It's a long title. The author is Michael Whitwer. And yes, Gary Gygax and the Birth of Dungeons and Dragons. The author is Michael Whitwer. The audiobook is read by Sam Whitwer, who, if that name may be familiar to you, he does a lot of voice work for Star Wars. So a lot of the Clone Wars stuff. I think he actually did the Emperor for a while in the Clone Wars. I know Tim Curry did it for a while. So Sam Witwer does a lot of work in the Star Wars world in terms of video games and the animation. But anyway, he read the book narrated the book. And it's really interesting. As somebody who is not a fan or just never really gamed, I found this to be a great story and a great biography about this man who maybe some of you know a lot about him. So this is just rehashing information that people know, but I thought it was a great format. Each chapter started with a few pages of a game going in, you know, there like was like adventure. Dungeon Master. Yeah. Yes. Like they would like narrate it. Like it was you're in the middle of a game.
You're in the forest. The fire is crackling in front of you. You hear noises around you.
Yeah, that's how they started every chapter, which I thought was a cool device, and especially if you're listening to the audiobook to hear it narrated that way. And it just goes from how he came about starting this, how there were, I think they called them strategy games at the time, how he was a big fan of playing those in the 1950s and 1960s, and how that eventually grew to him developing. I had no idea Gen Con actually started before Dungeons and Dragons. He was one of the people who started Gen Con. And it's a really interesting birth, and then how it took off, and it gets to all, you know, when there was all the controversy in the 80s that it was all like Satan worship and all that garbage, and but really interesting and a very interesting guy, and I found it to be a really interesting read. And again, I'm not a gamer, so I imagine if you are a gamer, this is very good. So and I recommend the audiobook too. I thought that was great. So again, it's called Empire of Imagination, Gary Gygax and the Birth of Dungeons and Dragons by Michael Whitwer. So check that out if that is something that aligns with your interest. Rajan, you're into all sorts of nerdy stuff. Are you into role-playing games at all?
I am, actually. I played a lot when I was younger and then went through a phase of many years where I didn't play because, you know, I was grown up and I didn't do that kind of stuff. And I didn't know anyone who did that kind of stuff anyway. But I think it was years back, I heard about people, you know, writers playing games at conventions just as kind of one-offs. And I thought, that sounds really great. And I tapped a bunch of my local writer friends to see if they'd be interested. And, you know, we got together and formed a little group, and it's kind of morphed and changed as people have come in and out. But I try to at least get a game in once a month. And it's been really fun, especially with creative people, people who, you know, can come up with great character ideas and, you know, creative solutions to problems. I mean, I always have to run the games because no one else wants to do that. But it's except for in one particular case, I'm playing in a Star Wars game right now with a friend of mine and a couple other people who I'm a player, which is great. But yeah, I've been doing it a lot more recently, kind of revisiting my my childhood in a way.
I find that is one of the greatest things that the writers that we have on this show have in common. It's a very high percentage that still play games, got their start as a creative storyteller through playing games. Patrick, we all know that you play these games too. Did you play these games before you started writing? Did they kind of go hand in hand?
Yeah. My friend Tom in high school, we would hang out. There was a bunch of us, you know, all rowdy boys, and we would just hang out, play video games, different things. And one day he brought me these books that he had. He said, I've always wanted to play this game. I don't really understand how to run it. You're a smart guy. Figure it out and then let's play. And it was Dungeons and Dragons. And so that was high school. And we started playing Dungeons and Dragons, and it was hilarious because we would play in the library at Fresno High at lunchtime. And we always had a crowd of onlookers around us. And like people didn't really, they didn't want to jump in and play, but they just stood there and watched us and listened, and it was hilarious. And we just kept playing from there.
Cool. Roger, I'd like you to comment on this because I had this thought, read a lot about developing your skills, whether it's as a writer or any kind of skill, whether it's a musician or anything like that. One of the things is this idea of deliberate practice, how you're practicing these skills. And in one of the books that I read, they use the example of, and I might be pronouncing it wrong, the Bronte sisters, who were these authors who were quite prolific. And they had this thing growing up where they had this pretend world that they created as children, and they would just tell these stories and make up these stories. And there was no pressure, and they were just playing, but they were practicing storytelling. So they had all these reps of storytelling in before they started writing sort of professionally, or however you want to put it. And I almost feel like so many authors grew out of role-playing games because it's play, but you're getting your reps in, but no one's judging, oh, that's not a well-written sentence, or this doesn't make sense here. I mean, I guess if you have some really harsh players, they do that. But what do you think of that idea of just getting those reps in a kind of low stakes environment?
And before you answer that, I just want to say you could tell that John has never played because he doesn't understand that there's always that person at the table who immediately corrects you and tells you that you're wrong and quotes the rules to you. Anyway, go ahead.
I think that's a really good way of looking at it. I mean, when I was really young, there was primarily just me and this one other friend of mine who used to play. He was a few years older than me. And at first we sat down with the rules and the dice and everything. And we created characters. We played D&D. We also played some superhero stuff a little bit later. But we got to a point where we just kind of stopped using the rules at all and would just kind of talk it out with each other and just do it kind of freeform, you know. And we had these huge like sagas that went on, and our characters, you know, would go up in these crazy levels and start their own kingdoms and things like that. So I definitely think that that had a great effect on me because, you know, you're doing it with somebody else, and not that they're judging you, but they're expecting you know, certain storytelling norms from this kind of thing, and will pose questions and pose problems, and you have to come up with solutions. So I think it was really, like you said, a great playful way of learning how to tell stories, or learning, you know, what kind of stories you wanted to tell. And then later on, my second phase of gaming was in college, actually, and I had a friend who ran a game, a D&D game, and he was very rigorous, and it was very much rules-based, but it was kind of like this exercise for the first time I had with playing one character and really kind of sinking myself into that character's head. And so when a problem came up, it wasn't like, what is me as the player going to make my character do? It was like, I am now in this character's head. How does he see this? How does he respond? You know, to the point where you were making sometimes stupid decisions because of who your character was, what their background was. And that was really important for me for later writing, just to be able to get into the head of a character, to give it life. And I even did some acting in college, and it was actually like really helpful for that, because I could kind of put myself in that character's headspace and speak as if I was speaking like him. My DM was very rigorous about, you know, you can only speak in the character's voice, no out of character talking unless it was, you know, a question or something like that. So I think that all definitely helped understand story, understand character, and things like that. So
We did that when we first started playing World of Warcraft. My friends and I, that I met actually through the game itself, had a guild. And then we started meeting role-playing guilds. We were a role-playing guild. And there was a role-playing guild called the Tears of Draenor, who was never out of character. Ever. They every time they were logged in, they were in character. And so we had OOC chat, but they stayed in character. And that was really impressive to us. And so we kind of emulated them a little bit. And I've told this story multiple times. I struggled writing female characters until I role played one.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was like all these doors opened and all these lights went off and bells and everything. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I can write this character, you know, because I was doing it every day in the game.
Yeah.
It's
That's
amazing.
Great.
Yeah.
One of the things you guys kind of both brought this up made me think of it. Stephen King talks about how when he's writing, he writes for an audience of one, and that's his wife. He thinks about his wife and what she would think. And from what the two of you are describing, and Roger, you kind of even said it specifically, by doing these role-playing games or World of Warcraft or what have you, as your storytelling, you are literally telling the story to one people or one small group of people. So Roger, what do you think about that is in terms of really directing your storytelling towards a very small group, maybe even one person? Do you think that has an influence on the way that you write your fiction as well?
That's actually, I mean, it's really interesting. I've never really thought about that. When I sit down to write, I don't think I have a specific person in mind. However, I think you have to be cognizant that you're telling a story to somebody else. I mean, you know, people always say, write the story that you want to read, and that's great, but you need to realize that you're communicating something, and that person does not have a line to the inside of your head, so you really have to kind of craft what you're trying to say. And so I think that ties into what you're talking about, in that, you know, you have to have, you're trying to tell a story that at least one other person or maybe a small group of people can understand. You know, my girlfriend also reads my stuff early on, and she's kind of like my first reader. I don't think of it as writing to her, but she definitely will tell me if things are coming across or things aren't coming across. So I guess I didn't really envision it in that way, like I'm writing to an audience, but you definitely have to. I think, you know, we don't write for publication without the expectation that we want someone to read it. I just guess I don't have a clear picture of who that would be.
And the complete and utter fear that someone's going to read it.
Right, of course, yeah. That's the
as soon as they read it, paradox. It's no longer mine.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Roger.
No, I was going to say, I actually think I do like the fact that it's not mine once it goes out, because I love the idea of taking something that to me means one thing and having it almost sometimes transform in somebody else's head. Like, they're not going to see the same pictures that I see in my head. Yeah. They're not going to get the same sense of things. And that part I enjoy it, but definitely there's a crippling fear and insecurity that happens every time.
I've had this conversation with other writers before because I've said the exact same thing you just did, which is, you know, I have a certain vision, but once it's out there, it's going to be interpreted by each individual who reads it. And yeah. I did have an argument with an author who said, well, no, that's not right. That's wrong. They shouldn't do that. You know, it's my vision. And I said, well, okay, let's say that you get this book published and you're sitting there and you've got a line of people who are wanting to talk to you and get your signature in the book because they love it. And the first person that comes up to you says, I love this because this character really spoke to me because of da-da-da-da-da-da, which is not at all what you meant. And the author said, then I'm going to correct them and I'm going to tell them that that's not what I intended. I said, you can't do that. You can't. You're going to totally ruin that experience for that person. And they're never going to read your stuff again.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in part of the writer's job is to leave enough space so that the reader can engage and use their own imagination to fill in those blanks. So, yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the wonderful things about reading novels. Even though we're in the golden age of television and we have our Game of Thrones and all that, which are all wonderful, and I love all that stuff, there is still something to be said about the visualization in your own mind and the, you know, putting all the pieces together. And you may not get it right. You know, you may be imagining one character looking totally different than what the author intended, but it doesn't matter. I think it becomes your own interior world for the time that you're reading it. And I think that's an experience that cannot be duplicated anywhere else through any other medium, even though all those other mediums are great too. And I think we all enjoy movies and TV shows and all that stuff equally. But that, I think, is what is special about novels and the reason why many people still read and enjoy novels, even though I think the death of the book has been something that has been complained about for probably 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, probably since television and probably since radio. People are like, oh, no more books because we're all just going to listen to radio now. So it's still around, and I think that's one of the reasons why. Rajan, now, again, you have Raining Fire out now, and as you said, you think this is the last book. As to close the episode, I did read a blog post that you put up a while ago about how this is sort of the ending of a chapter of your creative life and how this started through your experience at Clarion West. And maybe you can send our listeners off with a little bit of the story, or just like a brief summary of your experience putting this together and where you're at now with it, now that it's for better or worse done.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the idea came about years and years ago. And I always thought I would write this novel, the first one, Falling Sky. And you know, at that time I was like struggling to break in. I'd finally gotten an agent. And it just kind of, these novels are very fast paced, kind of, I hopefully seat of your pants kind of reading, you know, they're good beach reading, I would say, hopefully. But the experience has been sort of like that. You know, I sold the first book without it being actually finished. I had the deadline for that one. That one came out and I was immediately on the hook for the next one, which hadn't been written yet. And so it's been this kind of fast paced ride, which has been great because I've kind of been forced to learn from the crucible of not having a lot of time and trying to kind of realize where I was making mistakes and correct them very quickly. So, you know, in this 4-year process, 3 books in 4 years, I've learned an awful lot. And hopefully that comes out in this third book, which I think is probably the best of the three. But you know, it's been so fast paced and I was able to put the ending on the series that I wanted to do. And so now it's kind of like I can step away, take a deep breath, and start something new. I mean, this is a very different voice for me. It's a very kind of, you know, it's a present tense kind of first person narrative. And I'm looking forward to trying new things because you get locked in once you're doing 3 books in a series. You know, you have the same characters, you have the same kind of voice that needs to kind of be spread throughout the books. And so, you know, I'm looking at the future as an opportunity for me to stretch and try new things and kind of refresh myself. And you know, it's scary because obviously I could fail at trying something new. You know, if I, I have a YA project. And I know that the temptation is like, oh, now he's going to go into YA because that's so popular. But it's really like it's a concept that I think is firmly rooted in the young adult age range. But the point is that, you know, I could fail, but that's kind of exciting too, because it means that I have to kind of jump out there and try something new. And I'm really looking forward to do that.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to what you're doing. I'm looking forward to reading Raining Fire and finish off the trilogy myself. So that is available. Is that available now, or what is the release date on Raining Fire?
Yeah, it's out now. It came out July 18th.
July 18th. So it is out there, people. So go
happy
and pick
book
up
birthday.
Yes. And go and pick up the first two books in the series as well. Any con appearances coming up or anything else you want to tell our listeners about before we go?
I'll actually be at Gen Con, the con started by Gary Gygax that we learned earlier, August 17th through the 20th.
Nice. Very good. So if you're in that area, if you're going to Gen Con, go and seek Rajan out. Maybe get him to sign some books. Go buy his books and get him to sign it. Authors love that. That's what I've learned. For us this week, once again, if you enjoy the show, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you would like to leave our listeners with?
The only thing I have, John, is that my book is in a story bundle. And are you familiar with story bundles?
I am. Yes.
These support not only writers, but also charity.
Mm-hmm.
And right now my book is in the Bump in the Night thriller bundle on story bundle. And if you are I guess the way it works is there's 15 books in the bundle, a 16th book if you are a story bundle newsletter subscriber. And nice. If you spend $15 base, you'll get all 15 books. And then if you're a newsletter subscriber, you get the 16th bonus book. My book is in the bonus part of the bundle. So you have to at least spend 15 to get everything. Mm. But that's essentially 15 ebooks for $15, which is a great deal. And so my book's in there, Into the Fire. You also have Christine Catherine Rush is in there with The Devil's Churn. You have my friend Travis Heerman has co-written a book, and it's called Deathwind. That's in there. Let's see, what else is... there's lots of different stuff. Dean Wesley Smith's The Deep Sunset. Kevin J. Anderson has Unnatural Acts is in there. There's just a ton of books. Like I said, 15 books. Cold Hard Steel and Red Hot Steel by Alex Berg. Yeah, just lots of different things that might interest people. And it's going up right now. It's on Story Bundle. There's also a link from my website, atfmb.com. It ends on August 16th. It's a great opportunity to, you know, get a bunch of really great books to read for the summer and support a charity and support me and other authors. So I definitely suggest you spend like at least $30.
Right.
Come on.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a great deal. Pull the trigger on those deals. You won't regret it. You really won't. Plus, you have the charity component to it.
Exactly.
So you can always feel good about that. So awesome. All right, everybody, go do that. Rajan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Everybody else, have a great week.
Thanks, Mo. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.